From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. President-elect Barack Obama's Treasury nominee probably won't be confirmed by Inauguration Day. Timothy Geithner is in hot water over his tax returns. And the president-elect says he could flex his presidential veto muscles if Congress turns down his request for the remaining bailout funds. Here to help break down the day's political news, we've got Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post, and Jay Boone, a former political consultant for the Kerry Edwards campaign in Minnesota and the managing director of Gateway Strategies. Hi, gentlemen.
Hey, pleasure. Hello.
There. How's it going for you?
So, all right, let's start out with Timothy Geithner, Obama's pick to head the Treasury Department. He said that he failed to pay nearly $34,000 in taxes between 2001 and 2004. And it was also revealed that he employed a housekeeper whose immigrant work status has expired. So in this case, he may not be confirmed before the president is, sworn into office. Is this a big bump in the road for the president? What do you think, Robert?
I think in the case of Geithner, it's a kind of a small bump because even the Republican senators on the Finance Committee, they were still speaking fairly praiseworthy of him when this information came to light. However, it is kind of an embarrassment. I mean, not paying close to $40,000 in taxes, particularly when you're being hired to run the Treasury Department, which has oversight on collecting taxes and spending and revenue and so forth. But I think the bigger picture you got here is if you look at Geithner, not just by himself, but also in the context of Bill Richardson stepping down or withdrawing as Commerce Secretary, a lot of questions being raised about Mary Shapiro, who is the Securities and Exchange Commission pick. And you have to start asking this question, who's vetting these people? I mean, these are the kind of things that are supposed to be caught in the vetting process and dealt with.
That is definitely something some people are beginning to ask questions about. Do you think it's a fair one, Jay?
Look, it's certainly a bump in the road for the incoming administration. However, I think both Republicans as well as Democrats can certainly see that this guy's fully qualified. The error that he made was unbeknown to him. It came out during the vetting process. He immediately reached out to the Senate Finance Committee, as well as paid the back taxes. He was in a unique situation, or a position, rather. He was an employee of the IMF. At the IMF, they are required to submit W-2 returns, as well as to file as self-employed. So it's an interesting situation there, and it's a very, very easy, if you will, to get thrown off when you're filing your taxes. And Mr. Geithner also had an accountant look at his taxes and prepare them for him, and they made the error as well. So
when you mentioned the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and there are some specific rules that apply to employees there that not all of us would face the same situation. In fact, very few people would.
Absolutely.
And just like there are very few of us who, when you realize the mistake has been made, can write a check for $40,000 and pay it off that quickly.
Absolutely. That's a good thing these days. Overall, let's turn to another aspect of these confirmations and these nominees. Secretary of State nominee Hillary Clinton, she just sailed through her confirmation hearing yesterday. The closest that she got to a bit of a spat was when two Republican members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee asked her to make sure her husband's fundraising doesn't create a conflict of interest. And she pushed back and she said, she basically refused a suggestion to refuse all gifts while she is Secretary of State. That didn't seem to be a deal breaker, but it was one of these things where she just drew a line and said, hey, I'm not meeting an extra test of scrutiny. Was it important that she drew that line, Robert?
Well, in a sense, it is true that there's an extra level of scrutiny here. But let's keep in mind, you know, she's not your average Secretary of State nominee. She's a senator, obviously. She is a former First Lady, and her husband is the one that is creating these conflicts because he has a foundation that it receives a lot of money from foreign entities. So I think the extra scrutiny, the question about the extra scrutiny is certainly a fair one, and it should be kept in mind that one of the senators who urged former President Clinton not to take any more foreign donations, Richard Lugar said that, who's the ranking Republican on the Foreign Relations Committee, and John Kerry, who is the chairman, said, you know, Senator Lugar wasn't just speaking for himself, he was speaking for the entire committee in raising this question. So I think it's certainly fair.
When you take a look at the big picture, Jay, and having done the work that you have as a political consultant, how do you think the team that's been put together is going to change when the president is inaugurated? How do the dynamics of a transition team change once people actually have their positions?
Sure. Well, in terms of the prospective cabinet picks, the only thing we can go off of right now is their testimony and what they have stated that they intend to do. I think one thing that we can certainly look at from from the president-elect, his selections thus far, is that all these folks intend to take a very pragmatic approach. I mean, you look at Hillary Clinton, and she praises the value of diplomacy just as much as she states the significance of defense. You look at Mr. Geithner, and he understands that there's a connection between Wall Street and the free market, as well as the influence and the significance of government involvement and regulation. So I think with all these elections, what you will see is somewhat of a very centrist approach and a centrist approach as well as a desire to look at both sides and draw some conclusions from that.
Yeah, and in fact, the president-elect was even dining on a Tuesday evening.
Absolutely.
with a number of the leading lights of the conservative movement.
So I was about to ask you about that.
I mean, all I want to know is where was my invitation?
Your invite?
I just I'm feeling George Will and Bill Kristol are dissing me. I'm taking it personally.
You know, it did strike me though that you know. Were there any non-white men in the group at all?
You mean aside from Barack Obama?
I mean, who are part of this little coffee clutch of conservative?
It's kind of hard to find.
From what I understand,
there are conservative white women and black men.
Columns? No, Armstrong Williams wasn't there. No, Jason Riley. Yeah, you've got a good point. You've got a good point there. I don't know. It's possible that I don't know. It was all kept. It was a very small part of the vast right wing conspiracy. Let's put it that way.
It was a small white part of the vast white ring conspiracy.
Is that what you're saying?
That was a joke, folks. But
sorry,
hey, but
trouble.
It's time. You know, hey. It's time for black people are in. You know, it's time for you to claim your seat as part of the vast right wing conspiracy.
The black elite have risen. It's true.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Go get yours. but speaking of getting yours, the question is, what do any of us have waiting in store for us financially with this whole bailout? We had DeRoy Murdoch on, a black conservative
who also was not at the dinner. By the way, DeRoy's a friend of mine.
Yes, exactly. He was not at the dinner, but he was on our air yesterday. And gave a pretty scathing critique of how he felt the Bush administration had rolled over. And he even made a remark, and he said, I want to call him Comrade Bush. Those are some very strong words. Do you think that President Bush has betrayed Republican fiscal ideals by going along with this bailout, which some people say is not being held to high standards of accountability for where the money's going. I'll start with you first, Robert.
Well, there are two questions there. He admitted in his farewell press conference on Monday. He said that the bailout was I don't think he said betrayal, but he said it was he had to ignore his conservative ideals for that because he was told that there was a real crisis and this kind of money was absolutely needed. However, that said. The fact is, like unfortunately a number of other large projects that the Bush administration has launched, the oversight has been nil. Henry Paulson was basically given this blank check and kind of weaved back and forth as to exactly how the $350 billion, the first half of the installment, was going to be spent. And at still this point, the banks have said, well, yeah, we've got the money, but we're not exactly saying how we're spending it. And I think it's Obama says he needs the other half of it. I think I'm with the Congress on this one. If I had my druthers, I'd say, forget about the other $350 billion. I think it would be better to put it back in the Treasury and use it as a down payment on this gazillion-dollar stimulus package that we need to put together. I think that would actually get to real people faster than all of this fiscal chicanery going on in the background.
All right, Jay. Very quickly, what do you want to see? Just one thing that you want to see out of the next moves with this whole TARP and bailout?
Sure. Well, two things, actually, not just one. First off, I certainly think that tax cuts are needed within reason. But ultimately, I think what we have to do is we have to use this bailout to spur new jobs, to create new jobs. I think that's key. And so there has to be a balance. I understand that those on the right would like to see a significant amount of tax cuts. However, obviously, those on the left do not want to see the same trickle-down variety of the past that often doesn't work.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Farai.
We were speaking with Robert George, the associate editorial page editor for the New York Post, and Jay Boone, a former political consultant for the Kerry Edwards campaign in Minnesota and now managing director of Gateway Strategies. They joined us from NPR studios in New York. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. News and Notes digital producer Jeffrey Bennett gives us his take on the blogosphere every week. Usually we corral him into talking about our blog, News and Views, but today we want to take a look at large. How are you?
Doing well, Farai. How are you?
Oh, great. So we're taking a look at the big picture here. We've got Roland Burris waiting to be sworn in later this week as the new junior senator from Illinois. He is filling President-elect Barack Obama's vacant seat. And the appointment by impeached Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich was controversial from the start. So what's the word online?
Well, overall, there's a tone of suspicion and skepticism, namely over the role Burris's race played in his appointment. Brandon Whitney of Homeland Colors wrote this on his blog. Burris is a joke, but the rabid support of people who we don't believe in just because it's politically expedient is no laughing matter. And blogger Chris Rabb of AfroNetizen is even quoted in an Associated Press article saying this, "If there was ever a playing of the race card, this was it. Blagojevich may be crazy, but he's not stupid."
Well, with President-elect Obama's inauguration less than a week away, what are bloggers saying about that?
Well, another day, another simmering controversy, right? So the head of the Alabama NAACP says there's an aspect of Obama's inaugural parade that he finds offensive, and it's the traditional inclusion of the trail maids. It's these women who wear those big pastel hoop skirts with the bonnets and the umbrellas. He says those women in those dresses remind him of slavery. So Danielle Belton, the black snob, writes, "I'm sorry, I wasn't aware that we black people ran out of real problems and only had mock outrage to deal out."
All right. I also understand a few bloggers are taking preemptive measures just in case people get too carried away with their Obama worship next week.
Right. And Michael Fauntroy on his blog is tackling this talk of an Obama presidency ushering in this wave of post-racial Americanness. So he debunks all that. And then a blogger, Corey Richardson of Vexed in the City, actually called in to read us some of what he wrote in a post called "An Open Letter to Black People Regarding Barack Obama / Jesus." So here's part of that.
"Just so you know, Barack Obama doesn't have time to care about the following black issues: reparations, the NBA, police brutality, teen pregnancy, what happened to UPN, dogfighting, whether or not to put Big Mama in a home, pardoning your favorite rapper who just might be in jail, side note, keep your head up, Cool C, whether or not universal health care will cover the Sugar or the Williams sisters.
So there you have it. Barack Obama does not care about the Williams sisters.
Man, that's the I don't know. He's going to get some pushback on that right. one. He is going to get some pushback on that one. Well, Jeff, as always, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes. He joined me from the studios of NPR West. Now we've got our bloggers roundtable and some of the hot topics that folks are talking about online. The Congressional Black Caucus takes a look at how its role is going to change with a black presidency. And Mr. Obama's step-grandmother brings White House warming gifts all the way from Kenya. Plus, some experts warn the bad economy may fuel more hate groups. With us, we've got Wayne Hicks, known in the blogosphere as The Villager. He writes the blog Electronic Village. Writer Imani Channel, who blogs at My Urban Report, and political analyst Lenny McAllister. He blogs for sites including Hip Hop Republican, The Root, and AOL Black Voices. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
So, for 40 years, the Congressional Black Caucus has been the center of black power in Washington. But as President-elect Barack Obama prepares to take office, some caucus members are raising questions about whether a black man in the White House could affect their agenda and their influence. There have been tensions within the group. Most recently, caucus members were split over whether or not Roland Burris should take over Obama's vacant Illinois Senate seat. It now looks like he's going to be sworn into office on Thursday. So, some folks say the caucus is going to be more powerful during the Obama presidency. Others say absolutely not, quite the opposite. Imani, what do you think?
This is definitely an opportunity for the caucus to maybe look at itself, reestablish its goals, and engage perhaps Barack Obama in some conversations that will further their mission. And while there may be some questions about their power, obviously their role is to represent their constituents on the congressional level. Barack Obama is going to be the CEO of the United States of America. So they have two different missions. And he's, of course, he was voted in by all of America, not just by black voters. So this is a chance, I think, for them to maybe look at where they've been, where they're going, and perhaps have further discussions and use leverage their power to really affect the kind of change that they've been working for these past years.
Lenny, you blog at sites including Hip Hop Republican. One of the issues that's faced the Congressional Black Caucus has been an almost non-existent participation of Republicans. There have been so few black Republicans in Congress. And then when they are, some of them, like J.C. Watts, choose not to participate as part of the Congressional Black Caucus. So when you have a president who seems to be governing from the center and who seems to be choosing a very, not nonpartisan but bipartisan way of looking at Washington and looking at how he needs to get things done, how does the CBC fit into that?
Well, I think one of the things that the CBC is going to be able to do, and I think this is a genuine opportunity for black America within the political arena, we have to understand, and this is more of a philosophical approach, we're going to have to move away from looking at one leader and moving towards an avenue in the 21st century where we have multiple leaders with a diverse background and diverse philosophies to help push black America, because black America is a diverse subculture within the culture of America. Therefore, the CBC, just as with inclusions of Republicans, as we start having more black Republicans elected into Congress, which I do think will happen starting in 2010 moving forward, we're going to have to make sure that we stop going towards what we're finding and what we've done over the last 50 to 100 years, which is idolizing one black leader, and start embracing an idea of diversity within a diverse group. We're going to have to look at diversity within black America and move forward with that. If the CBC is focused on that, they'll be able to tackle different problems simultaneously, including, you know, from a Republican standpoint, reengaging a centrist president in a more leftist type of organization such as the CBC, because they're mostly affiliated with Democrats. They'll be able to do that, as well as go after the everyday problems that we're facing in black America and bring about solutions, both governmental as well as grassroots, that will make the permanent changes that we're going to have to start putting in place in 2009.
There's also another completely different level of diversity. The recently elected congressman from Louisiana, Congressman Gao, is asking to be part of the Congressional Black Caucus, although he was born in Vietnam. Vietnam and is Vietnamese American. Wayne, you know, we've discussed this in the past. What do you think should happen in the age of Obama?
I agree with the other two bloggers that it is a tremendous opportunity for the Congressional Black Caucus. They really need to get back and look at their original purpose to promote the public welfare, you know, through legislation. That's where they need to focus, and for neglected citizens, that's what they need to do. And they need to start using some of the 21st century tools that they saw Barack Obama using. They need to be more engaged with their constituents in their districts, and then since they want to represent the African American community, you know, reach out to us through some of the Web 2.0 tools and social networks that are out there. They have a rare opportunity with a African American that is the president, a former member of the CBC. They're going to have a member of Senate that's in the CBC. That, you know, the course of our history, that has rarely happened. This will become the fourth senator that we've ever had. So I hope they take advantage, just relook at why they exist in the first place and get back to their original mission and purpose.
If I could jump in, as far as the discussion, though, if they should be allowing non-black congressional members, this is really a chance to, I mean, having a non-black member of the Congressional Black Caucus, that's going to hopefully increase the discussions perhaps among the non-black lawmakers. So this would be a chance for them to get added exposure to the issues that are important to black lawmakers, the black community, and maybe be more engaged in the conversations and be more aware of some of the challenges and the issues that are going on. So I would hope that perhaps they can be a little bit more forward-thinking. Of course, it's the Congressional Black Caucus, but I mean, this is 2009 now. We have to sort of, the more inclusion of voices, the more we can work and have conversations about, greater conversations, hopefully, about change.
Well, there are some people who are not doing too well with change. And I'm talking in this specific case about white supremacists. There are plenty of people who have bias, and, you know, in fact, I would argue most people do on some level, but with the economic issues this nation is facing, it is apparently a great time for hate groups to recruit people who feel like they've been left out, particularly if they've been pushed aside for black people, immigrants, people of color. How do you see, I mean, there's, for example, the internet recruiting has just gone wild. How do you see, Imani, the issue shaping up? Is this something that we should pay attention to?
Obviously, it's something that should be paid attention to, just because, I mean, any time you're having a hate group that may be threatening the citizens of America, whether they be black, white, or otherwise, you should be paying attention to it. I think there are agencies in this country that are focused on these groups, especially in the wake of Obama being elected and soon to be inaugurated. But, you know, in reading through some of the research, it seems like there are a small amount of people who are actually would act on perhaps violence or carrying out these acts. However, you know, it's balancing freedom of speech versus the real threat. I mean, are you going to limit a person who has hateful feelings or hateful thoughts about another person, which, of course, we all should be working towards unity? It is the United States of America. However, you there's a fine line. I mean, you can't step on people's rights to express themselves. However, if they are going to do physical harm, if they are going to commit crimes against other people based on their race, then you have to monitor, keep a close eye on. Obviously, the internet's going to be a great forum for those to remain anonymous in their activities, to remain anonymous in their recruiting. So there's just it's one of those fine areas where, you know, people are going to do what they do, especially with the internet being the open forum that it is. However, you just have to make sure and monitor, and hopefully the federal agencies that are watching these groups make sure that the citizens are safe.
And there's a kind of odd set of studies that are coming out. You know, sometimes you get studies that almost seem to contradict each other. One is that there was a recent study about online racial discrimination and linking it to depression, anxiety, specifically in teens, just the ways that we interact online. And, you know, when you go to read the comment boxes, for example, on a lot of news stories, you'll find random racial comments. And it said that that's really affecting teens. On the other hand, there's another study, Canadian researchers tested people's reactions to anti-black comments and found a high tolerance for racial slurs, including the N-word, and just sort of that people had zoned it out. I'm not sure what to make of the fact that those two studies are that different, but do either of those resonate with you, Wayne?
The one thing that I've learned over the course of time of being on the internet is I probably do zone out nonsense more so now than I originally did. Teens don't have the benefit of years of you know, wisdom or years of activity on the internet to be able to zone it out, perhaps. But, you know, I just, it's not that it's nonsense. I hope the people that are running different sites, you know, will exercise a little bit more editorial control over what they allow to take place. I just try not to get involved. I will say that on the hate crime issue, I think the other thing that's going to drive it, in addition to Obama and his election, is just the economic downturn and the unemployment. That always seems to drive people to some of their to some of their more base emotions come out when they are worried about being able to just afford, you know, afford their homes and to protect it, to afford to take care of their children and that kind of thing.
Lenny, when you look at the questions of race, do you think? I was having a conversation with someone about the way in which this election seems to have lifted everyone up a little bit in terms of their basic knowledge of the history of race in America, whether it's civil rights history, you know, history of Reconstruction, whatever. We have a little bit more of a baseline from which to have these conversations. Do you think on a political level that regardless of whether or not you wanted Obama to win, regardless of what your politics are, that we may be able to look at race in a way that integrates the conversation about race into the conversation about politics?
I hope so, but I think one of the things that we're finding, and I think to tie it back to the studies, it serves as an indicator of, is that people feel that we have gotten into a post-racial America with the election of Barack Obama without reminding themselves that, yes, he did have a some regards, a typical upbringing as far as growing up middle class, but he did not have the typical African-American experience. Two Ivy League degrees doesn't make you the typical African-American experience or even the typical American experience. And as we well know, we still have issues within Black America that impact people a lot differently than it impacts the rest of America when it comes to unemployment, life expectancy, disease, violence, incarceration, and education. So if we just solely look at, and this is what people I think unfortunately are doing, they're looking at the example of Barack Obama and saying, we have overcome. We haven't overcome quite yet. We have broken down a major barrier. And if we use just the Barack Obama example in the political realm and the social realm to say we've gotten past someplace without saying, okay, that is one step, what's the next step? We're going to find ourselves stagnating. We're going to find a tolerance for racism that we're starting to find on the internet, that we're starting to find in society. I mean, let's not forget, right after Barack Obama won the election on November 4th, we had slurs sprawled everywhere from billboards to college campuses about him winning. So obviously there's been some stuff simmering. It was the myth that we would eventually have a Black president, but now that it's become a reality, we'll see exactly where we are, and it's going to go forward with the first criticism, the second criticism, all the way through, which is why, as far as I'm concerned, we need to not only look at where we've come in politics with Mr. Obama becoming the 44th president of the United States, we have to take that momentum and move it forward so that we can now use that as a solve to heal Black America and then heal America past its racial wounds and start reinvigorating the American potential. That's where I think the key is going to come into play.
I want to mention just a very sweet story, which is that Barack Obama's Kenyan step-grandmother, this was his grandfather's wife, is on her way to the U.S., and she's going to witness the swearing-in.
Granny.
Yep, 86-year-old Sarah Obama. And she was hoping to bring a traditional spear from her Luo tribe as a gift for her grandson, but for security reasons, she's not allowed to bring it on the plane. She is bringing other symbols of power, a three-legged stool, a fly whisk, and a shield. And those are all very traditional items of leadership. But do you think that given all the work that he has to do, that she needs to get him that spear, you know, even if it's by parcel post?
He should take Air Force One and go get it. That's what I think he should do. What's the point of being the president if you can't do things like that?
Yeah,
that could be his first mission.
Yeah, exactly. Keep Congress in line. Anyway, on that note, thanks, guys.
Hey, thanks for
Take it easy.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Wayne Hicks, otherwise known as The Villager. He writes the blog Electronic Village and joined us by phone from Cincinnati. Amani Channel blogs at My Urban Report. He was at Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. We also had political analyst Lenny McAllister. He blogs for sites including Hip Hop Republican, The Root, and AOL Black Voices. He was at WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. Go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. Next on News and Notes, we hear from a Congolese rape survivor and a South African man who was a rapist. Both are now trying to prevent future sexual violence. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. The eastern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo became a breeding ground for rape during the deadly conflicts that began more than a decade ago. Rape survivors carry such a stigma that they're often rejected by their own communities. In 2001, a militia snatched Honorata Kazende from her village and her family. She was held and used as a sex slave for more than a year. Then she escaped. Despite the devastating experience, Kazende has rebuilt her life with help of the human rights group Women for Women International. She now works for the group as an organizer. She joined us with her translator to talk about the sexual violence in her country.
Et moi aussi, je dis merci pour cette opportunité.
I thank you for this opportunity.
Now, in 2001, you had a family and a career as an educator. That was a couple of years before the official end to the Second Congo War. What was your life like?
Ma vie, c'était une
I had a very good life, well organized and happy with my family.
The militias came then. What was life like in the year that you spent in captivity with the militias?
J'étais esclave.
I was taken as a sexual slave. It was more than hell.
Cela signifie que c'était une vie qui était.
It was not human life which I was living there. They could kill me. They were threatening me. If I could refuse, they could just kill me.
How did you escape?
Je me suis échappée.
The Congolese government came to that area to attack these rebels, and it was at that moment our perpetrators were fighting. We managed to escape.
Did you have any women who were too afraid to escape?
Nobody among us was fearing. The pain we had underwent was too heavy, and we were preferring to die far from that area where we were in captivity.
Did any of these men ever explain why they felt the need to abuse you sexually?
No, on ne se parlait pas avec eux puisque.
We were not talking with them. They have their own way of communicating with us, and it was beating us, raping us.
You escaped. You found your children. Did you find your husband?
My husband remained in the villages where I was taken into captivity. But me, when I escaped, I didn't go back to my village because of the shame. I decided to come to Bukavu town. And when I arrived in Bukavu town, there were also other people who escaped from a village, among which my three children. So I'm victim of violence twice. When in 2004, I was also victim of rape in Bukavu, where I escaped.
What did you have to say to your husband? Were you ever able to talk to him?
No, jusqu'à présent, je ne l'ai pas encore rencontré.
Up to now, I never talked to my husband, and we never met.
How can you survive spiritually and emotionally through all of this?
Oui, je survis
I survive because of the fact that as I didn't die in the bush, following all what happened to me, I have the reason to live and not to just deny myself.
I understand that you lost the will to speak for some time. How did you start speaking again, and when?
Cette volonté est revenue à moi à
partir Since my participation into the Women for Women International program, I start regaining that confidence to speak out.
Tell me about what it means to you to work for Women for Women. What is it that you do And how does it make you feel?
Je me sens bien parce que, d'abord, à partir de ce programme,
The program took care of me. They have assisted me. They have trained me to know my rights. My rights in being in good health, my right in exercising my politics. These all have helped me to stand and to be confident.
Do you think that the government or other groups are doing enough to change things?
En tout cas, pour les problèmes de gouvernement,
I don't want to go to talk about, but what I would like to talk more is how the humanitarian aspect around all what is happening to women. Following the fact that the country still, the eastern part still insecure and in a war, there is many consequences in terms of there are many displaced people. Following this instability, women are most vulnerable and they are facing on the daily basis getting raped and infected by HIV/AIDS and all other transmitted diseases.
Aussi pour la question de logement.
So in this context, we found that women and the population does not have access to sanitation, access to water, and they don't have a shelter. So they are living in a critical situation and condition.
Have any of the men who raped you and assaulted you been brought to justice in the court system?
C'était difficile puisque je ne les connaissais pas individuellement.
No, and because, first of all, I don't know them individually or their names, and I was raped by more than 20 men, and I was in constant shifting in the villages, in the places where I was captive. It means for maybe 2 months, I can be to an area, and after that, we shift in the bush, going side to side with different rapists.
You're one of a growing number of Congolese activists against rape, but are there any men who do the work that you do, who try to teach other men how to treat women with respect and to not add to this system of assault?
Oui, dans notre organisation, nous avons
yes, through Women for Women program, we have a men's leadership training program which aim to sensitize them so that they may be the advocates and also so that they change the attitude towards the women who are sexually violated.
But when you meet men who have this history, even if they're engaged in the work of trying to help other people, do you trust them? Do you trust that they would never do this again?
Oui, parmi les hommes, puisque toutes les personnes ne sont pas.
Yes, I can trust them because all the men are not rapers. They are those who are really determined to help us in this process because they feel that inside of them, this is destroying the entire community. So for me, I can trust that there may be men who can change and be the advocate for women's rights.
Honorata Kizende is a rape survivor who now works as an organizer for Women for Women International. She recently received an award for humanitarian work. Her translator, Christine Karumba, is director of the same organization in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Gender inequality and disparity plagues cultures all over the world. Post-colonial African countries are no exception. Dumisani Ribombo is one of a growing number of African men who are changing their ethics and behavior when it comes to how they treat women. Dumisani is part of a South African human rights group called Men as Partners. I asked him why South Africa still has such a problem with gender inequality, which expresses itself too often in the form of rape.
Well, there are many reasons. I think you can repeal laws from the books, but, you know, Some people still carry certain things in their hearts. For instance, the apartheid system got so many people into thinking that you could only solve conflicts, you know, through violence means. Yes, we have the constitution, which is very, very progressive. I think one of the reasons that some people in our society just want the government to be the director of this change alone. And I think in a democracy, everyone should get involved. And this is where the Menace Partners Program come into play and say, how do we cascade those beautiful human rights from the Constitution down to the ground?
Let's talk very specifically about your life. You grew up in Limpopo, in the northern part of South Africa. And at age 15, you actually participated in a sexual assault. What happened? Take me to who you were at that age and then what you did.
The apartheid system had this migrant system, which resulted in many fathers being absent from, you know, from homes, having to go to the cities for work. And as a result, as boys, you learned about who a man is from other boys. And so the expectations from, you know, other boys played a bigger role. Those men that were there as well were not that exemplary. You know, for instance, I've seen a lot of violence around me on women, and this was not talked about. You know, into the religious circles as well, I would witness how women were treated differently. Personally, I was jeered at as a boy because I just have two sisters and I helped at home. The socialization then was that a boy should not help at home, you know, you're just like a sissy. So I was constantly jeered at. It was more of saying, prove to us that you're a boy. I mean, a cousin of mine sort of gave me an ultimatum to say, if you want this to stop, there's this girl that thinks she's better off than anybody else. We need to teach her a lesson, meaning that we need to, you know, sexually molest her. And I was terrified. And they gave me beer and weed to smoke. And I succumbed to that pressure. I'm not saying in no way that I shouldn't have owned up to my own actions, but the pressure was there. I think it's important that I mention that. And that's what happened 15 years ago. And it never bothered me for like 20 years that I've done something wrong. And
so,
I just went on with my life.
Let me stop you for a second. So
right.
you were 15, she was 14.
Mm-hmm.
And how many boys were there?
Three.
So there were three of you, and you were drunk and high. And you say that you had felt a sense of relief because you were finally off the hook for not being the kind of young man that your friends thought you should be. Did you talk to your family at all about it? What had happened?
No, I didn't actually until later in the years when I got involved with the Menace Partners Program. And I think I should mention also that it wasn't because we're high. I mean, this was a decision that was made when we were all sober. It was just that I was afraid to do it, and hence the use of alcohol and weed. So it wasn't because we're high. I wouldn't say that.
How did you get along with women after that experience?
Well, I, just like the boys during my time, most of them, I still regarded women as, you know, second-class citizens. But from time to time, I'd question why women were treated differently than men, and, you know, why wouldn't they be seen as important as I was seen as a boy. And then religion played a bit of part towards transformation as well, you know, messages about love. If you love someone, why would you hurt them and that? Yeah, but from time to time, you know, I would carry those prejudices that made me think I'm better off than girls. Me, in fact, the girl that I married, I can count several times when, you know, I had sex with her when she didn't even want to. So, because the belief was that, you know, I could have it anytime I wanted to, and she just had to comply. So, yeah, growing up, that's the kind of man I've been. And but my life started changing. And when I met the Menace Partners Program, that's when I would say, you know, like the last nail was hit in to say, look, I cannot just live by perceptions or, you know, allowing just societal expectation to rule my life. I need to be Dumisani and do what is right for me and the people around me.
You went back. You apologized to the woman who you had raped when she was a young teenager.
Yes.
What, you know, what unfolded? What was that scene like? What did you tell her why you wanted to talk to her?
Yeah, first I told my pastor and said, look, I was in this training and I just got to realize that I needed to live my life differently from now on and so forth. I want to go back and apologize to this girl, this woman that, you know, I raped, you know, 20 years ago. He was like, no, why do you do that? Why go back to the mud? You saved now, you know, the truth and all of that talk. I remember him asking me, what if the girl goes to the authorities? And I said, yeah, I'm ready for that because that'll be justice for her. And against that advice, I went back and I told her how sorry I was for what I did 20 years ago. She just looked at me and she started crying and she said to me, you know, after you and your cousin, two other men did the same thing to me. And I've never spoken about this, not even to my husband. Sometimes he wonders why. You know, like crunch when he touches me because, you know, my life has never been the same since then. And I remember feeling like, whoa, this is like another heavy load just being added to me because I thought when I speak to her, I won't go around feeling guilty anymore. But I think when she told me that, you know, for the past 20 years, her life was so terrible emotionally because of my actions. That was too much to bear because I was thinking, wow, I just went on with my life after that and never thought of it, you know, never thought that I've done something wrong. It just dawned to me right then that I have to stand up and do something about sexual violence. She then said, look, I forgive you, and I'll do my best to try and forgive the other man. But hey, this has been a very rough thing, and she just stood up and went away.
That was Dumisani Rabombo. He's a South African activist for gender equality, and he joined us from our New York studios.